From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why homegrown marijuana plants are more potent today than in the 60s, and what separates genetically engineered potatoes from the rest of the potato world. We talk with Michael Pollan, author of the new book, The Botany of Desire, the story of how we have bred plants that fulfill our desires. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Empire Falls, the new novel by Richard Russo. It's about a group of people living in a decaying mill town in Maine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge in Denver has refused any further delays in the execution of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. Federal prosecutor Sean Connolly said Judge Richard Mache was convinced that newly released FBI documents didn't affect the fact of McVeigh's guilt.
Judge Mache found that for anybody that sat through the evidence and heard the evidence at trial, there can be no doubt that Timothy McVeigh exploded a Ryder truck bomb outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building on April 19, 1995, killing 168 men, women, and children, and maiming and injuring scores more.
McVeigh attorney Robert Nye said the defense team will ask a federal appeals court for a review.
Of course, we are extremely disappointed in the court's ruling today. We will file on Mr. McVeigh's behalf an appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit, and it is to that issue that we must turn our immediate attention.
McVeigh's execution is set for Monday. The Senate is now under Democratic leadership after Vermont Senator James Jeffords officially switched from the GOP to become an independent, voting with the Democrats. The Democrats hold control by a very slim margin, and Majority Leader Tom Daschle began today with a call for bipartisanship. The two sides are still negotiating on a plan to reorganize committees and reallocate prime office space in the Capitol. Senator Robert Byrd, as the senior Democrat, assumed the position of Senate President pro tem, which makes him third in line for the presidency. He takes over from 98-year-old Senator Strom Thurmond. Democrat Tom Daschle has become the Senate's new majority leader after the defection of Vermont's James Jeffords left the GOP in the minority. Daschle called for a new era of bipartisanship in the Senate, but there are signs that such harmony is unlikely. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The mid-year shift of power in the Senate due to a defection has never before happened in Congress, but not even half the senators showed up to see Daschle take over as majority leader. Among those absent was James Jeffords, who caused the seismic shift in the Senate's balance of power. Daschle called on those present in the Senate chamber to change their sharply partisan ways.
We need to prove to the American people that we can overcome the lines that all too often divide us. We need to prove that we can do the work the American people has sent us to do.
But a cloud of uncertainty hangs over the Senate's transition, largely because Republicans have not agreed with Democrats on how to organize committees now chaired by Democrats. Republicans want assurances that President Bush's nominees won't get bottled up in those committees. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks, the Dow lost 105 points today. This is NPR News. Los Angeles City Attorney James Hahn will be the city's next mayor. Hahn got 54% of yesterday's vote to beat former State Assembly Speaker Antonio Villaraigosa. Both men are Democrats. The trial of two nuns accused of involvement in the 1994 Rwanda genocide is expected to go to the jury tomorrow. Douglas Baction reports from Brussels, where the trial is taking place.
Sister Gertrude and Sister Maria Casito are accused of collaborating with a militia mob that butchered and burned to death minority Tutsis hiding on the grounds of their convent. Sister Gertrude told the court Wednesday she was trying to save her community and she didn't want the refugees to die. She said Rwanda was in total chaos and she had to make difficult decisions. Sister Casito said she didn't respond to the expectations of local widows, referring to women seeking protection at the convent. She said she did not give anything to the militia to do harm. Witnesses say she supplied gasoline used to burn a garage where people were hiding. She expressed trust in Belgian justice. Both sisters say they are innocent. The trial has run for more than 7 weeks. The accused face a maximum life sentence. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Faction in Brussels.
A jury in Los Angeles has ordered Philip Morris to pay more than $3 billion to a smoker who suffers from brain and lung cancer. After deliberating for 9 days, the jury awarded $3 billion in punitive damages and $6 million in compensatory damages to Richard Boken. Lawyers for the tobacco company said Boken was aware of the risk of cancer but continued to smoke. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 16 points to close at 2,217. The S&P 500 lost 13. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why are American apples sweeter than they were in Johnny Appleseed's day? Why is American marijuana more potent today than the homegrown of the 60s? And what separates today's genetically engineered potatoes from other potatoes? These are some of the questions Michael Pollan answers in his new book, The Botany of Desire. He explores how humans have selected and bred plants that suit our desires, and in doing so, have altered the plant's evolutionary destiny. Pollan is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's an urban emigre, a former magazine editor who gave up city life for the country. His new book focuses on apples, potatoes, tulips, and marijuana. I asked him why he chose marijuana as one of the subjects of his book.
One of the very key things that plants do for people is intoxicate them. Every culture on Earth, with one exception, has had a psychoactive plant that they used to change consciousness. The one exception are the Eskimos, and the only reason they didn't was because nothing would grow where they lived. If you're going to look at the relationship of plants and people, you really have to look at an intoxicant. And it could have been the grape, and it could have been the opium poppy, but I just thought the story of the marijuana plant was such a fascinating one, and I had some direct experience of it, so it seemed like a good one to delve into.
Now, as you point out in your book, homegrown marijuana, marijuana that was grown in the United States, in the 1960s and 70s was very weak. So a lot of people who tried to grow it and smoke it were very disappointed in the results. Why was it a not very effective intoxicant in the 60s and 70s when it was grown in the U.S.?
Well, it was a tropical plant, and it grew very powerfully in the tropics in places like Hawaii and in India, where it's grown very commonly. But when people took the seeds from the marijuana that they bought, which was mostly marijuana that had been grown in Mexico, very carelessly, in fact, these plants wouldn't do very well here. And one of the great ironies of the drug war is this plant that really did not have much of a purchase. I mean, looking at it from a natural history point of view, on the American continent, this wasn't really its habitat, except for a few corners in Northern California and Hawaii. So it took the drug war, really, to create an environment in which this plant could thrive here.
What did the drug war do to create an environment that helped the plant thrive here?
It's a funny environment, really, because it consists of closets and basements. So you have to stretch your understanding of environment. But basically what happened, it's almost like the Newtonian principle of you act here and you have an equal and opposite reaction. So basically with the drug war, you had people spraying paraquat, an herbicide, on the Mexican marijuana. And then Ronald Reagan sends the helicopters into the hills of Humboldt County to rout out the people growing there.
Humboldt County, California.
Yes, excuse me, which is sort of the original hotbed of domestic marijuana and one of the few. And they forced the growers indoors. And once they forced the growers indoors, the plant had, as it turned out, this wonderful opportunity. If it could do two things, if it could provide a sort of a feeling, a magic, so powerful that people were willing to risk their lives and their property for it, and if it could adapt to this strange new environment, growing indoors under these 1,000-watt lights 24 hours a day and all these high-tech fertilizers and CO2 tanks sweetening the air for them. If it could adapt to that bizarre atmosphere, environment, it would thrive. And what's happened essentially is marijuana has now a whole continent of new habitat, thanks largely to the drug war. What was this, you know, rather mild plant with a THC as the active ingredient of about 3% is up to 15, even 17%. So this marijuana, you know, that you can't even go near without really falling on your face at this point, has evolved, essentially. And we don't normally look at things like the drug war from the point of view of natural history, but from the plant's point of view, which is really what I'm trying to get at in this book, the drug war has been, it's almost like an acid soil for a conifer. You know, certain kind of plants love an acid soil. Well, the drug war is the acid soil in which marijuana has thrived.
You describe this wave of innovative breeding in the 1980s, you know, performed by people working secretively, growing marijuana indoors. Do you think these people were consciously breeding for certain characteristics in the marijuana? Do you think that they really knew what they were doing in a technical way, or was it just a kind of hit and miss thing that chanced upon a way of growing a hardy marijuana plant indoors?
Well, probably both. I mean, there was a lot of we'll try anything and see what works, which is, you know, the way evolution works, trial and error. But also, there was an understanding. Whenever you're breeding, you have an end in sight. You have a goal. You have your utopian version of the plant you're working with. And they understood that if marijuana was going to grow in this new environment, it had to get a lot smaller, because you can't grow 16 feet tall plants in an 8 foot high basement or in a little closet. And it had to grow faster, because you didn't really want to stay put if you're growing marijuana, since the police were likely to knock down your door. So they crossed two great strains of the plant. And there was one, a northern strain from Afghanistan, and then there was this tropical strain, sativa is the tropical strain, indica is the northern strain. And so they very knowingly put them together, because they understood that cannabis indica was a much smaller, stouter, very potent plant that, since it grew in a northern latitude, had to flower and get to seed more quickly than sativa, which took its sweet time about it, since it grew near the equator. And they brought these two things together. They also learned along the way, though, that the high associated with each of these strains was very, very different. And the way people talk about it is sativa is a very kind of head high as opposed to a body high. And some people call indica's blue collar pot. I mean, they're for just, you know, if you want to, at the end of the day, you want to just kick back and not think. And sativas allow you to function a lot better. And so they started modulating these effects, and they did create marijuana for different highs, but also to deal with different maladies, because, you know, marijuana, like a lot of plants, is a medicine also. And for certain kinds of, for appetite, one would be better than the other. For pain relief, indicas are supposedly the best. So a lot of this was very deliberate, you know, and I've met a lot of these breeders and growers, and I spent time in Amsterdam and in California meeting with them. And what really hit me was that the best gardeners of my generation, this is what they're doing. They're underground perfecting this plant.
Well, in writing this chapter about marijuana in your new book, The Botany of Desire, you've thought not only about how humans changed the form of marijuana that is grown in the United States. You thought about how marijuana changes our perceptions. And one of the theories you propose is that marijuana may actually remove some of the filters that consciousness normally puts between us and the rest of the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, people talk about marijuana turning us on, but it may be that it turns us off in certain crucial ways. I have to back up a little bit, though. What we've learned about consciousness from the study of marijuana has actually been extraordinary. You know, Allen Ginsberg and those people all said that marijuana would unlock the key to consciousness, and they meant smoking it, of course. But studying it as scientists has, in fact, unlocked some incredible new findings about the brain, about experience, about memory. Basically, what happened was, in trying to figure out why this chemical compound, THC, produced these effects, scientists isolated the brain's own version of THC, which they called anandamide, which is the Sanskrit word for inner bliss. As you can imagine, this was not an American grant from the government funding this research. It was an Israeli neurochemist who named it. And he discovered that there was a neurotransmitter network dedicated to this chemical. And this was completely new. We did not know. You know, sort of we have this opiate network, we have this dopamine network, and now we have this cannabinoid network. And then the question became, well, why? Why did we evolve to have this this network that's activated by this plant, but also this chemical that the brain produces on its own? Now, we didn't evolve to get high on marijuana. We did evolve to respond to anandamide. Anandamide has all the same effects of marijuana. It, for instance, causes short-term memory loss, has a big effect on appetite, has an effect on pain. And so they looked at where these receptors were, and they found them all over the brain, except in the brain stem, which controls involuntary functions like respiration and heartbeat. And that's the reason, since there are no receptors there and that area isn't affected, that it's very hard to overdose from marijuana because it doesn't close down your involuntary functions. They also found it in some surprising places, like the uterus. And what was this about? Well, the more they study it, the theory is that anandamide, the brain's own marijuana, is involved in pain control, specifically forgetting pain. And the phenomenon that women often talk about that it's very hard to recover the feeling of labor. You knew it was really horrible, but actually evoking it to yourself is difficult, may be a result of this chemical's ability to help us forget. But it also helps us forget information and other things. And this really baffled me for a long time. And I went back to this Israeli neurochemist. His name is Raphael Mishulam. And I sent him an email and I said, why would we evolve to respond to a chemical that makes us forget things short term? And he wrote back this somewhat elliptical email. And he said, well, do you really want to remember all the faces you saw on the subway this morning? And I had one of those aha moments and realized, well, gee, forgetting is not just a defect of the brain, it's actually a function of the brain. It is almost as important as remembering, because we take in so much information. We see so many faces in the course of the day and hear so many advertising jingles, and that unless we can edit all this sense information, we would explode. We'd go crazy. And this may well be the chemical that helps us do that. And there's probably another chemical that helps us lock in long-term memories. So this marijuana chemical is really part of the editing function of the brain. Now, editing is very much what goes on in changes of consciousness. If you read accounts of, and I'm not just talking about drug experiences, I'm talking about sports experience, extreme physical experience, I'm talking about religious experience. You read a lot about people who've managed to immerse themselves in the present moment. And you get the same kind of language, whether you're talking to a Buddhist or talking to a Christian mystic or talking to an athlete. You block out the future, you block out the past, and you're able to seize the present. And that is a process of forgetting. And,
so even focusing on things like why, if you're high on marijuana, might food taste more intense than it usually does, or why music might seem more dramatic than it usually does. You think it's because you're blocking out everything else that you might be experiencing?
Yes, you're blocking out all the static of experience. You're focusing on one thing, which, you know, when you smoke marijuana, can almost be a detriment because you just fix so narrowly on something, the rest of the world disappears, and this allows what you are experiencing it allows you to have something a lot closer to direct experience. You know, this chemical, whether in the marijuana form or in your brain's own version, turns us all into transcendentalists and romantics, you know, having that direct experience of nature or ice cream or Jerry Garcia. By the time you get to be an adult, your ability to experience things freshly, sweetness, for example, you know, children experience sweetness almost an intoxication. We kind of lose that.
Did the research that you did on marijuana lead you to find out anything about what frequent smoking might do to the type of short-term memory that you'd like to maintain?
Yeah, it hurts it. It's you know, if you're a student, it's a very bad thing to do. I didn't explore the whole issue of the negative long-term mental effects of marijuana, although that there is evidence that there are some. And I should be, you know, I want to say that I'm not holding a brief for marijuana or any other drug. What I think, though, is that, you know, we have a lot of trouble holding two contradictory ideas in our head, that drugs can be wonderful and drugs can be awful, that they're a blessing and a scourge both. And, you know, the Greek, the ancient Greeks were much better at this. They understood the power of wine and Dionysus and intoxication. But they also understood that it was such a powerful magic, it could turn you into animals, it could ruin your life. And so they surrounded it around with rituals, and they drank wine out of these tiny little cups, and they took their drug potions only, you know, at one festival every year in the fall. So I think they sort of had a healthier attitude than we do, where every plant is either, you know, this heroic thing that's going to save us or it's going to ruin us. And I think the ability to hold contradictory ideas in our head is a very powerful thing we're not terribly good at.
Well, that said, did this research affect your point of view and on either medical use of marijuana or the decriminalization or legalization of marijuana?
I spent enough time with medical marijuana patients in California to be very impressed with what this drug did for certain individuals, and talked to many, many doctors who swore by its effects, especially on things like certain kinds of pain relief. Marijuana, or anandamide too, doesn't really eliminate pain, but it helps you forget it. And that's really just as important for certain kinds of pain. Appetite. I mean, I saw AIDS patients who were dwindling away to nothing, and a combination of taking testosterone and smoking marijuana would bring them right back up to their normal weight in a matter of months. So it is a powerful medicine. This isn't news. You know, this was discovered by the ancient Chinese and the Indians, and they've known and they've used this for a long time. It's information we've forgotten willfully because, again, we can't tolerate the idea that something that could ruin your life could also help another person's life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Pollan. He's the author of the new book, The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World, and one of the plants he examines is marijuana. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Michael Pollan is my guest. His new book is called The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. And he looks at four plants and the way that humans have bred these plants for certain characteristics. One of those four plants is marijuana. Scientists understand a bit about how marijuana intoxicates people when they smoke it. But what does that intoxicant do for the plant itself?
What happens is, you have a plant that's doing something for its own reasons, you know, inventing a new chemical, because this is what plants are really good at. I mean, while we were nailing down consciousness and locomotion and walking on 2 feet, they completely nailed organic chemistry. And they can make compounds that we can't even imagine and manufacture them and design them. And then, of course, there's photosynthesis, which is an astounding trick, turning sunlight into food. Anyway, so they may have done something like this for their own purposes, but then what happens is strictly by chance, some human, or in the case of marijuana, possibly a bird, because birds really like marijuana seeds, probably because they're getting high. Animals do get high as well. And then humans started selecting the plants that produce the most of this chemical. And so gradually the evolutionary destiny of the plant is shaped by the fact that the plants producing the most THC are the ones that are making the most copies of themselves because we're taking those seeds and planting them. But marijuana had an interesting evolution. It unfolded along two paths. While people were selecting the plant for higher and higher levels of THC for medicine or for getting high, they were also selecting the same plant for fiber. And that, of course, is hemp, which until the last century was the most important fiber for both papermaking and clothing in the world. So the same plant was developed along that line for the longest, strongest fibers. And then after 10,000 years of this coevolution between us and the plant, you had two families. You had hemp, which has very little THC and really just gives people a headache if they smoke it. And then you have marijuana, cannabis, which is not a terribly good fiber, especially now that they've shortened it down to 2 feet or so. So, you know, evolution is it's really a concatenation of accidents, things that just happen and turn out to have some utility and are seized on. And I think that's probably what happened with opium also. You know, opium is an alkaloid, in a flower that seems to repel animals from eating it because it's so bitter. So they start out, you know, they have their own agenda, and then it gets crosswired with our agenda, and then we're off to the races. I mean, coevolution is underway. And the plant, after that period, and it's been 10,000 years or so since the invention of agriculture, is a completely different plant. Who's using whom is really the question. The marijuana plant, you know, yes, we selected it, we developed it, we talk about hybridizing it and changing it, but it makes just as much sense to say that the plant found this unwitting animal that would go to the ends of the earth literally with these seeds and give it this a world's habitat when it started off with just a little part of Eurasia.
So what's in it for the plant? It gets to grow more all over the
exactly.
world. Exactly.
It gets to conquer the world.
Yeah.
It's the old, you know, it's the evolutionary goal. I mean, we shouldn't talk in terms of intent and goals and evolution. It doesn't work that way. But the one sort of life force that we see is the desire to survive and to make more copies. And as you make more copies, expand your range. And all species will do whatever trial and error presents to make that happen. And in the case of these very ingenious species, the domesticated species, what was presented to them was this animal, Homo sapiens, who happened to be very thoughtful and able to change the environment and go all over the world. So if you look at agriculture in general, which happens 10 years ago, you know, we have this phrase, the invention of agriculture. Well, you know, stand back a little and you realize that's kind of conceited. It makes just as much sense if you look at things from a Darwinian point of view to say that agriculture is something that the grasses, because those are the main, you know, the wheat, rice, corn, something the grasses did to get the better of the trees. They got us to cut down the trees. So whenever you mow your lawn, you know, you think that you've got these grasses under your thumb, but in fact, they've got you preserving their habitat, because by mowing the lawn, you're keeping the trees from coming back. There's a war between grasses and trees in evolution. We weighed in on the side of the grasses, and it was the smartest thing the grasses ever did.
Michael Pollan is the author of the new book, The Botany of Desire. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You're letting the grass grow right under your feet. You're letting the grass grow on the busy street. Don't you know that love is grand? Don't you know I'm in demand? Oh, gotta have love, gotta have love, gotta know where I stand, yeah. Someone's gonna steal me right under your eyes. Why wait till they steal me? You'd better get wise. Give out with those kisses, baby, be sweet. You're letting the grass grow, it's growing, it's growing, it's growing right under your feet, yeah!
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Michael Pollan examines the genetically engineered potato and tells us how agribusiness is moving in on the organic food world. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Empire Falls, the new novel by Richard Russo.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Pollan. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and often writes about gardening. In his new book, The Botany of Desire, he investigates how we have bred plants that fulfill our desires, beauty in tulips, sweetness in apples, and potency in marijuana. And he focuses on a new development in the relationship between plants and people, genetically engineered fruits and vegetables. Now, one of the plants that you talk about in your new book is the potato, but not just any potato. You're focusing on the new leaf potato, which is a genetically engineered potato. It's part of the whole biotech realm. Why did you want to make sure you looked at a genetically engineered fruit or vegetable?
Because I think that this relationship, this 10,000-year-old wonderful co-evolutionary relationship we've had with these other species is changing. And I actually think that biotechnology, genetic engineering in particular, represents a whole new wrinkle in our relationship to plants. In the classical relationship of domestication, the plants propose new qualities, traits, through variation and mutation, and we select from that. But all these qualities already exist in the potato's genome. Blueness, bigness, nutritionness, non-toxicity. It's a give and take. They propose, we dispose. And in fact, Darwin says in Origin of the Species, man does not create the variation. Now we do. Now we shoot the genes of a flounder into a tomato. Why would we want to do that? Well, to make it so it won't freeze at 32 degrees, because flounders can go below 32 without freezing. In nature, in a billion years of evolution, the flounder would never lie down with a tomato and make a baby. It's just not going to happen. Now, that isn't necessarily evil. It's not to say it's bad, but it is to say it's novel. And whenever you do anything novel in nature, I think you've got to be awfully careful.
Well, let's look at this new leaf potato. What are some of the non-potato-like functions that have been bred into it?
Well, it produces its own pesticide in every cell, including the spuds, the part you eat. There is a bacterial toxin called BT that's often used by organic farmers, and it's a very safe and effective pesticide for the Colorado potato beetle. However, it's never been part of the human diet before, and now it is. And so the plant produces its own defenses, and it got them from a whole other corner of nature, from the bacteria.
So a potato beetle would be repelled or die if
it got to the potato plant? It takes a bite of a leaf and keels over and dies. I saw it in my garden. I grew these myself. My garden gave up its organic virginity for this experiment, and it is effective. I saw a Colorado potato beetle larva sicken and die.
Have you eaten the new leaf potatoes that you've grown?
You know, we've all eaten the new leaf potatoes, I found out. That was my shock. They were, until recently, in McDonald's French fries, in Frito-Lay chips. They're inescapable. I didn't eat the ones I grew. I sort of had a moment, though, where I realized I was going to serve these. I was invited to a potluck dinner, and I had this beautiful bag of potatoes that I'd grown. And I hadn't been able to get rid of them, and I sort of put off eating them, not for any ideological reason. I just felt a little creepy about it. And then I got invited to a potluck in my town at the beach, and I thought, great, I'm going to make potato salad. And then even before I could get the water to boil, though, I had, you know, these pangs. And the pangs were, could I serve genetically modified potato salad to my neighbors without telling them? And I said, well, obviously not. I can't, in all good conscience. And then I thought, well, if anyone else is bringing potato salad that isn't genetically engineered, mine's going to come home uneaten. Because why would you possibly want to eat this? It offers you no benefit and some, you know, some risk, however small. And then I understood with great clarity why these companies do not want to label their products.
Because they're afraid you'll not want to eat it.
Why would
you? For fear of taking a risk.
Why would you want to? I mean, they don't yet offer consumers. Now, someday they will. They'll offer us low-fat potatoes. They'll offer us more nutritious rice. But right now, there's no benefit for the consumer. All benefits, such as they are, for the farmer.
And the benefit for the farmer is the farmer doesn't have to use pesticide.
Well,
or as much.
Less pesticide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they actually could say that these potatoes didn't need to be sprayed at all, I think that, you know, that would be very appealing to a lot of people. And, you know, one of the things that struck me about when I was researching the potato, I went out to farms in Idaho, and I saw, you know, farms, tens of thousands of acres. The soil is essentially killed before you plant. You spray these fumigants that kill every bit of life in the soil. And the reason you're doing this is to control diseases. Then you plant your potatoes and you spray herbicide to control the weeds. And then you have 14 sprayings of pesticides. Some of these pesticides are so toxic that the farmers will not go into their own fields if one of their irrigation machines breaks. They would lose that field, because this is the desert, of course. They would rather lose that field than expose themselves or their workers to these pesticides when they're in the field. Some farmers grow their own organic potatoes by the house for eating during the season because they're waiting for the potatoes in the field to lose all their systemic pesticides. So it was kind of I was astounded by where industrial agriculture has brought us with the potato and with other crops as well. I mean, dead soil, poisonous plants, right up until the time they're sold.
So with the dead soil, I imagine that also sprayed on are a lot of nutrients?
Yeah, they also spray fertilizer. It comes the water. You know, they have these giant pivots. You've seen them if you fly over the west. You see these circles down in the desert, green circles amidst this scrubby brown, and out of that irrigation pivot is coming water, and fertilizer and pesticide in these systems. It costs a fortune, and in fact, potato farmers make virtually nothing on their crop because they're spending so much money on chemicals. The only people making money in agriculture these days are either food processors or chemical producers.
Now you point out in the book that part of the problem that these large agribusiness farmers face is that if you're growing one crop year after year and you're growing that crop over a large number of acres, you know, over a vast area, that these crops are going to be more vulnerable. Why?
Yeah, monoculture, I mean, if you could put the whole problem of American agriculture into a single word, it is monoculture. Grow the same thing over such a large expanse, and it's genetically identical. It is exquisitely vulnerable to pests. Because the pests are also in a co-evolutionary relationship with the plants, and they are evolving as quickly as they can to unlock the defenses of the plant and consume them, essentially, and eat them. And the plant needs to evolve also to outwit them. The problem with a crop like potatoes or apples that are essentially clones, you're planting genetically identical, you know, all russet Burbanks are the same all over the country, is that the pests get a chance to evolve and kind of break the locks and get in. So therefore, you've got to come to the rescue of these plants, which are really sitting ducks, and spray lots of chemical. If you were growing with greater diversity, if you had lots of different crops, you wouldn't have the same problem. If you didn't just plant russet Burbanks, which we do essentially because McDonald's needs them because they make the longest, most golden French fry, we wouldn't have the same problem. You know, the potato famine in Ireland, which seems so long ago and far away to us, is... we're doing the same thing with the russet Burbank now. That was the reason there was a potato famine is all of Ireland was essentially planting one kind of potato, the lumper. And when a blight came along, which is a fungus that could unlock that potato's defenses, overnight, all the lumpers in Europe turned to a black rotting mess. And so monoculture, if there's a single evil, it is that. And the problem is, though, monoculture is very important for driving down the price of food, for, you know, our cheap food economy. I mean, the logic of capitalism drives you toward monoculture. The logic of nature is resisting and driving you toward biodiversity. And there's a fundamental clash between those two systems, I believe.
Well, you visited a lot of organic farms. What do organic farmers do differently?
Organic farms basically nurture the biodiversity in the soil and amongst the plants. They will not grow one kind of potato. They will grow many, many different kinds and many different crops. They won't grow the same crop year after year. And by mixing things up this way, you don't allow the pests, the insects, to build up their numbers. You also have the insects, the pests of one species may indeed help you control the pests of another because it may be a predator. They take care of the soil so that the soil provides a lot of the nutrients. And they grow. Their basic premise is if you take care of the soil, the plants can then take care of themselves because these are plants less dependent on us to come to their rescue with chemicals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Pollan, and he's a contributing writer to the Sunday New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of the new book, The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Pollan. His new book is called The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. Now, in a recent New York Times Magazine article, you wrote about how agribusiness has taken over a lot of organic food companies. What are some examples of that, of things that you might have seen on the shelf that really were small companies and have now been bought by agribusiness?
Yeah, well, as organic has begun to prove itself in the marketplace, the big companies that sell Americans their food want it in. And, for example, Cascadian Farm is an old organic brand started on a hippie collective farm in the 70s. It's now part of General Mills. You wouldn't know that reading the box. It still creates this impression of supermarket pastoral of a small farm where people are tending these raspberries very carefully. In fact, they may be coming from as far away as Chile. What's happening is as organic food gets bigger, the same pressures toward monoculture are being felt. And there's a real tension there. And there's reason to worry. I mean, I think organic agriculture still is a great hope for American agriculture. I don't think it's going to solve all the problems. But if it is industrialized, which is starting to happen, you're going to find that it's just as processed. You know, now there are organic TV dinners that are full of synthetics and additives, and there's organic milk that is ultra-pasteurized, which means it's more processed than the regular milk you get. So that there is a danger that as organic catches on, it'll get diluted along the way. And but what happens is if you're selling vast quantities of corn and you're freezing it, the processing machine, even the combine, can't make the turns in a small field, so you end up planting giant fields of all the same variety because that's what processes well, and that's what the processors want. So you see the whole kind of pattern repeating itself, which is definitely a cause for concern.
There are big organic superstores now, stores that are like supermarkets, but they deal only with, quote, organic foods. Is that feeding this trend, too, of
no
organic
question.
Combining with agribusiness?
Yeah, no question. I mean, Whole Foods and Wild Oats and those companies are selling large quantities of organic. And I should point out, that's a wonderful thing in one way. You know, I mean, here's, again, an example of we have to hold two contradictory ideas in our head. By selling it on this scale, and now I understand Walmart is going to get into organics, when you start selling organic on that scale, you're going to have thousands and thousands of acres being treated organically, and that represents an enormous improvement over what we have. That said, it will not be the same organic as it was when it was smaller, and a lot of these pioneering farmers who developed it will be crushed by the big agribusiness farms. But it's not good or bad. It's very good in some ways. And I saw industrial organic farms where it was kind of a mixed farm. They'd have 10,000 acres of conventional and 2,000 acres of organic, and the farmers were learning the virtues of organic, and they were switching over to organic pest controls, and they were putting compost in their conventional fields. So there's a cross pollination going on, and that's a very healthy development.
What are some of the organic pest controls that are used for large organic farms?
Well, this brings us back to our potato story, BT, the pesticide that is put inside those crops, and this is another problem with these crops. It is a bacterial toxin found in the soil called Bacillus thuringiensis, and organic farmers have used it with great success. The way they use it, it breaks down overnight, just in sunlight it breaks down, and therefore the pests have never been able to develop resistance. Now, with all these BT crops, because in addition to potatoes, there's corn that's BT, there's cotton that's BT, we are putting so much of this bacterial toxin in the environment that even the Monsantos of the world acknowledge that pests will develop resistance. And the key organic pest control will not work within 5 to 10 years. So it represents a real taking on the part of this industry of this public good, which is BT.
Well, so the organic food industry would be in trouble if their major pesticides ceased to work.
Yes. I mean, the organic food industry has many threats from genetic engineering, and that's why the two camps have been in such opposition. But genetic modification will probably cost them their most important pesticide, but it's also contaminating their crops because these genes that, we've read about Starlink corn contamination, these genes don't stay put. And, genetic pollution is very different than chemical pollution. Once a gene gets into the environment, it reproduces, it copies itself. So you can't clean it up the way you can an oil spill, and it doesn't fade. So you're getting genes, flounder genes and these kind of things that will be in organic crops as well. So that safe haven that they've set themselves up for will not exist in a few years.
What concerns you most about genetically engineered foods?
Well, I think that the more serious threat is probably environmental, and we probably don't know what it is yet. I think from a health point of view, I'm less worried about health threats from eating it, although they may be there. But environmentally, we are introducing something novel into nature. And whenever we do that, the effects show up where we least expect to find them. You know, DDT is the great case study. I mean, here was this wonderful new chemical. It wasn't terribly toxic to people. It passed all its toxicological tests. We started spraying it like crazy, and it really worked on mosquitoes and malaria in turn. And then suddenly the bird population crashed. No one thought to look at the thickness of birds' eggs, which is essentially what was happening. DDT was staying in the food chain. The birds were eating the bugs. Their eggs were collapsing as they sat on them. So when you make a change in nature, because everything is linked, the effect is often very far from where you're looking. And the other problem is we're not looking very hard. You know, these companies, they're not concerned with these relationships the way they should be.
Michael Pollan, where do you get most of your food? Do you grow most of it in your garden?
I wish I could. I grow a fair amount. I've got a large vegetable garden, but I shop at the supermarket like everybody else. But ever since I wrote that article on organics and did the research for this book, I've started to really look around me more closely, and I found some remarkable resources in terms of organic milk that isn't processed at all, in terms of people growing grass-fed beef and farmers' markets. So I do as much as I can locally. And given a choice now, given what I've learned, I think between something locally grown and something that's labeled organic in the supermarket, I think I would opt for the local. Because, you know, one of the things, farms give us many things besides food. They give us a kind of landscape. And I like a rural landscape. I like seeing farms in the New England town where I live, and I don't want them to go away. That's another thing they produce. So I buy local when I can.
You say you don't like to see the farms go away. Now, you're one of the urban emigres who have moved to this mm-hmm. farm country. Are there a lot of other urban emigres like yourself who have moved out there, and are you part of what's changing the farm landscape?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'm part of the problem. I mean, the farms are disappearing, and a lot of them are being bought by New Yorkers for second homes. But that said, if the people who move to the country will patronize the local farms, then they'll survive. And so it's very, very important to do that and not just assume if you see that organic label that that's the end of the story. Organic is not the last word. I think local. I think a shorter, more legible food chain. I mean, if I learned anything from this, it's, you know, Americans really have forgotten where their food comes from. They think it comes from the supermarket. And the shorter and more legible the food chain is, the healthier will be the agriculture. If, you know, a farmer to farmer's market looks you in the eye and you ask him how he grows his potatoes, and you're going to find out. And that's the best pressure. I mean, a labeling scheme is a substitute for actually meeting the farmers who are growing your food.
What got you to move from New York to farm country and to make gardening the subject of your writing and to focus so much of your life around gardening and acquiring food?
Well, I started gardening. This was a second home. I was living in Manhattan working as a magazine editor, and this was a second home, and I took up gardening and fell in love with it, and then realized in the course of having a war with a woodchuck at one point and having to deal with pests, that this was a wonderful laboratory to look at our relationship to nature. You know, Americans, when they want to think about nature, always go to the wilderness. You know, you have the Thoreau, the tradition of Henry David Thoreau and John Muir, and this is supposedly where we go for our insights into the natural world. I actually think that's kind of a lousy place to go. I think there's a lot more to be learned in the garden with domesticated plants. This is where we really mix it up with nature. This is where we go, where we have to get something from nature without ruining it. Where we engage. And I'm very interested in the places where we engage. And by looking at plants, you know, the wonderful thing about domesticated plants is they're sort of a compendium of nature and culture together. You can read these plants and learn about us. In the same way you can look at a wildflower and learn what a bee thinks is beautiful and what a bee thinks smells good, you can look at a russet Burbank potato and learn what makes us tick. And so I just found that in plants, you could learn an immense amount about people. And so I've used my garden and my plants to write about everything from drug policy to food to architecture. And I think that, so I think it's a wonderful place to go to think through our relationship with nature, far better than where we usually go.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Michael Pollan is the author of the new book, The Botany of Desire.
Tulip or turnip, rosebud or rhubarb, filet or plain beef stew, tell me, tell me, tell me, dream face, what am I to you? Diamond or doorknob, sapphire or sawdust, champagne or plain homebrew, tell me, tell me, tell me, dream face, what am I to you? Do I get the booby prize? Or will I be the hero? Am I heading for blue skies? Or is my ceiling zero? Tulip or turnip, moonbeam or mud pie, banknote or IOU, tell me, tell me, tell me, dream face, what am I to you?
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by Richard Russo. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Richard Russo specializes in capturing the humor and the messy humanity of small communities fighting against extinction. His novel Nobody's Fool was set in a working-class town in upstate New York. It was made into a movie starring Paul Newman. In his new novel, Empire Falls, Russo burrows deep into a dying town in Maine. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Not one wrong note. That's the most amazing thing about Richard Russo's new novel, Empire Falls. In a nearly 500-page story that spans generations and features such risky minor characters as a sassy waitress and a dirty old man, you'd think the literary odds would mandate that Russo would scribble a false bit of dialogue here, a canned observation there. Not so. Empire Falls flawlessly creates a fully realized world that's at the very least as engaging, hectic, and probably even as stupid as the one you fled by opening the book, with one irresistible difference. In his fictional realm, author god Russo doles out frequent epiphanies and measured justice. Russo's marvelous novel takes its title from a fictional old mill town in central Maine where the story is set. Like many of Russo's other literary locales, Empire Falls is an isolated place, dying a slow death. The working-class citizens of Empire Falls appreciate that, in a cosmic sense, the joke is on them, and has been ever since the 1970s, when the town's main employer, a textile mill, was bought by an international conglomerate. Within a couple of years, the mill was gutted, its mortgaged machinery disassembled and placed on trucks bound for Georgia and the Dominican Republic. Russo's main character here, Miles Roby, is a direct inheritor of this disaster, since his late mother Grace spent nearly her whole working life in the mill's adjacent shirt factory. 40-somethinger Miles now runs the Empire Grill, a greasy spoon landmark currently experiencing an upswing in business due to the patronage of faculty and students from a nearby college who've decided the grill is quaint. When the novel opens, Miles is in the midst of a divorce, and he's worried about the emotional fallout on his beloved teenage daughter, Tick. Because this is a small town, Miles finds himself regularly serving coffee to his almost ex-wife's boyfriend and running into folks he's known and in some cases disliked since childhood. A constant thorn in his side is Mrs. Francine Whiting, the matriarch of Empire Falls, whose husband's family founded and sold the mill. Mrs. Whiting claims she's left the Empire Grill to Miles in her will. But since she's as wily as a Maine coon cat, there's reason to suspect that she's just stringing Miles along in revenge for his mother's long-ago affair with her deceased husband. A constant thorn in Miles's other side is his con man father, Max, an itinerant house painter and irregular bather. Here's a snippet of Miles's ruminations on his father's wet sneezes. Max regarded covering his mouth as irrational behavior. The way he looked at it, you might as well cover your ass with your hand when you farted. See how much good that did. There's a shocking act of violence towards the end of Empire Falls, but essentially, the novel is about taking stock at midlife. It explores the way Miles, a thoughtful, gently depressive man, comes to terms, or doesn't, with the major decisions he's made, consciously or not. Chief among them was Miles' decision to drop out of college when his mother was dying of cancer. As Russo shrewdly shows, a little higher education is a dangerous thing in Empire Falls, dividing not-quite-college graduate Miles from most of the people he serves at the grill. Maybe one of the reasons Russo is so great at unsentimentally but generously depicting failing communities and the people left behind in them is because, as a literary novelist at the high end of the mid-list, he knows what it's like to be stranded in a world fast becoming extinct. Empire Falls might just airlift him up and out.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Empire Falls by Richard Russo. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Bones of the Master, A Journey to Secret Mongolia, a travel memoir by George Crane, in paperback. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why mosquito bites itch and sometimes kill. We talk with Andrew Spielman of the Harvard School of Public Health, author of the new book, Mosquito. And we meet actor Jonathan Pryce. He plays Gustav Mahler in the new film, Bride of the Wind. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.